can turn what seems like a marathon into a series of sprints. Sprints cover the same ground, just in shorter, more manageable intervals. This technique is a slightly adapted variation of a similar approach deployed in agile software development, but it can be powerful for tackling any type of goal. Even more modest-sized goals can usually be broken down into smaller goals that can fit into the most impatient person's life. I fit that description. Breaking down goals into sprints mitigates the risks of being overwhelmed and fatigued. If you're no good in the kitchen, but you're determined to change that, don't start by serving souffles to six of your fancy foodie friends. Even if it all works out, the pressure may make the experience so unpleasant that you'll risk spoiling your curiosity for cooking altogether. Feelings of hardship can quickly eclipse those of curiosity or satisfaction. Start with a smaller, simpler dish and see how you feel when it's done. How are sprints different from just dividing a goal into phases? Unlike phases, which are not ends in themselves, sprints are independent, self-contained projects. Thus, the outcome is, let's hope, a source of satisfaction, information, and motivation to keep going. Or, as happened with my stop-motion animation project, a helpful cue to let this particular goal go. One author and entrepreneur, for example, was curious about podcasting. It was something he knew little about. Rather than dedicating himself to becoming a podcaster, he set out to do 6 episodes with his friend Kevin Rose. That experiment turned into The Tim Ferriss Show, the #1 business podcast on iTunes with over 200 episodes and over 100 million downloads. It goes to show that we shouldn't underestimate the potential impact of small, focused projects. The first version of bulletjournal.com was also the result of a sprint. To set up sprints, structure them around specific subset goals or skills needed for a long-term goal. To return to the cooking analogy, here's how that might look. Long-term goal, learn how to cook. Possible sprints, learn knife skills. Learn how to sear and saute, adding tasks for other methods as you go. Learn how to select fresh vegetables. Leveling up to tasks for selecting fruits, meats, poultry, etc. Learn how to cook eggs. Setting up related tasks one by one, hard-boiled, scrambled, over-easy, an omelet. Sprint requirements. 1. Have no major barriers to entry. Nothing preventing you from starting. For example, to learn knife skills, you don't have to purchase an entire expensive set of chef's knives. You just need a basic kitchen utility knife that you may already own or can buy with minimal investment. 2. Consist of very clearly defined actionable tasks. Your knife skills might be broken down into holding a knife properly, sharpening, peeling, slicing, dicing, cubing, mincing, and so on. 3. Have a fixed, relatively short time frame for completion. Should take less than a month to complete, ideally a week or two. Just making a salad several days a week and mastering a simple vegetable soup recipe would get your knife skills up to speed pretty quickly. Following these 3 rules will keep your sprints focused, actionable, and manageable. When structured correctly, it should be hard to come up with a valid excuse to postpone a sprint. If you think a sprint will take longer than a month, just split it into 2 smaller sprints. The point is to safely indulge your curiosity and try things on for size without wasting time. Brainstorm. Before we can break down our goal, we have to wrap our head around it. Now that you've picked your goal and created a collection for it in your bullet journal, use the first spread to brainstorm the what and the why. Dig in and explore. Write down whatever comes to mind. This process gets the gears turning. I've included an example of what a brainstorm could look like for the Learn to Cook goal in the bonus PDF. When you're done brainstorming, you should have a better idea of your goal's requirements, its scope, its milestones, and why it's important to you. Now break it up into sprints. Each sprint can be laid out in another sub-collection in your bullet journal. Next, you'll break each sprint down even further into its tasks. Once you've listed out your tasks, start figuring out how much time each sprint would take. If you've ever had the privilege of working with a contractor, the same adage applies here. Take the time estimate and triple it. Progress is more important than speed. If something gets done more quickly than anticipated, great. There's nothing wrong with getting something done faster than expected, as long as you're not focusing on speed. What we want to avoid is falling behind. That tips our pleasure-pain scale toward the pain side and makes it harder for us to stick with the process. If you have the time, use it to your advantage. If you don't, reduce the scope of your sprint. Once you have your sprints planned, block them out on the calendar of your choice. Lock in a dedicated time to work through your tasks. Now you know when the project begins, how long it will take, when to work on it, and when it ends. The longer a goal takes to accomplish, the more it taxes your motivation. When motivation runs dry, goals tend to crumble. Sprint projects will help you reduce the load so you can enjoy the satisfaction of seeing regular progress. How you feel about a project is vital to its success, especially for personal endeavors, where you may not have a team or a boss to help you stay on task. Progress provides momentum. Momentum helps you cultivate your patience. A writer living in Sweden, Olof Weimark, believes one reason he fell into depression is that it felt like his task list never got shorter. He was using an app that erased a task whenever he checked it off his list. His breakthrough came when his computer crashed and he started using an old typewriter. Quote, "I found that I wasn't all that hard on myself for a typo. Since I couldn't edit out what was already written, I had to live with what I wrote or rewrite the entire page. Words started to really flow out of me. And lo and behold, when evening came, there was a stack of work that had been done sitting in a pile next to the typewriter. I started feeling good about my accomplishments again." Similarly, he says, the bullet journal is very tangible. Progress is apparent, and reviews happen continuously, every time you open it to make a new notation. He filled an old reservoir pen with blue-gray ink and went to town. Everything left open in my old system got transferred, planned, processed, or simply ignored. Dividing larger goals into sprints also acts as damage control. Perhaps one sprint doesn't work out. You realize that it's not for you, or you come across information or a situation that throws a wrench into the gears. If you planned your sprint well, shutting it down won't derail you from related sprints. At worst, you may have to shuffle around your schedule a bit. Successful or not, sprints provide you with room for reflection. In addition to daily reflection, which you can apply to your projects, not just your daily log, you have an opportunity, after each sprint, to pause and reflect on the experience thus far. For example, 1. What am I learning about my strengths, my weaknesses? 2. What's working and what isn't? 3. What could I do a bit better next time? 4. What value was added to my life? Perhaps you discover that you need to refine your master goal, given what you learned along the way. That's great. Suppose you realize that you just want to cook Italian food, or that you only want to cook for large groups of people, or that you're much more interested in growing food than cooking it. Whatever the case may be, these realizations will help you dial in your goal, allowing you to allocate your time and energy more effectively. Course correction just means you've uncovered something even more meaningful, and that's the point. Just reapply the lessons you learned from the last sprint to the next sprint. This self-perpetuating cycle allows you to continually grow as you close in on what matters. Small steps. I had three friends who shared three things in common: a soul-crushing desk job, a passion for yoga, and, at one point, a totally idyllic Instagram feed. You know the ones, posts of pristine white beaches bordered by lush palms and sky blue waters. Endless images of beautiful people laughing their way through coconut cocktails, lounging around beach bonfires. The first, let's call her Karen, quit her job, sold all her stuff, and moved to Costa Rica to become a yoga instructor. A year later, she was right back at her desk. Why? She said that she didn't enjoy teaching yoga to entitled tourists at a resort. She'd wanted to travel the world and experience local cultures. It didn't occur to her that locals couldn't afford to pay her to teach yoga, and that working on the road greatly reduced the pleasure of travel. It was the same grind, just with better weather, but far away from the people she loved. The second, let's call her Rachel, also quit her job for a yoga teaching position at a dreamy beach resort. A little over a year later, she resumed being a desk jockey. Her reason? She realized that teaching yoga took the fun out of it for her. What was once her treasured refuge became a job, and a much more physically strenuous one at that. The last, let's call her Lee, quit her office job a decade ago and has never looked back. She teaches yoga all around the world. What made her experience different? She started small. She began with teaching one class a week on weekends while still working her 9-to-5. An avid traveler, she used her vacations to experiment with teaching for a week or two at various resorts. It wasn't for her. Nothing lost, knowledge gained. Next, she tested being a guest instructor on retreats. Bingo. She loved retreats. They were intimate, fun, and profitable enough. The experience also gave her ideas for how she could improve on the retreat model. She started organizing her own local retreats. As they built steam, she moved them to more tropical places. And so it went. Rather than uproot her life, Lee took a systematic approach to accomplishing her goal. She approached change with patience and curiosity, gradually figuring out one piece of the puzzle at a time. That inquisitive yet methodical approach ultimately allowed her to successfully transition into and sustain a very different kind of life. Change is critical to productivity and growth, personal, professional, or otherwise. It can be a powerful way to alter our circumstances, but it can backfire. Large changes trigger our fear response. The more afraid we are, the more we need to calm ourselves. Many a great productive gesture or action has resulted in an equal or greater measure of inactivity. Peaks where we believe anything is possible are followed by shadowed valleys where we think maybe nothing is. So how do we affect change in a way that is sustainable without stressing ourselves out? In Japan, there is a concept known as Kaizen. Kai roughly translates to change, and Zen translates to good. Thus, good change. Another translation, perhaps tellingly, is continual improvement. Unlike in the West, where disruption is a buzzword for our favorite flavor of progress, Kaizen focuses on surfacing opportunities for incremental improvement. It's an approach to problem solving that takes the form of small questions, like, what little thing can we change to improve the situation? What could be done better the next time? This is a powerful way to suss out achievable improvements, which makes it much easier to enjoy continued progress. Though Kaizen originated as a method to improve the quality and company culture of the Japanese automotive industry, its application is universal. When applied to our daily lives, Kaizen can become a critical change agent. By bringing our attention to the little things, we can affect change while we avoid overwhelm. All we need to do is solve one small problem at a time. Each solution builds on those that came before it. And therefore, these small steps add up quickly, affecting massive change over time. In practice, ask small questions. In the goals chapter, we discussed how to accomplish your goals by breaking them down into smaller, self-contained sprints. Now, let's take these sprints and break them down into actionable steps, or tasks. Create your tasks through the lens of curiosity rather than by giving yourself commands or ultimatums. It's the difference between lose weight and what one unhealthy thing could I remove from my diet? Our minds respond well to questions because we're problem solvers. You can engage your curiosity by asking yourself questions to spark your imagination. What do I want to do? Why do I want to do it? What small thing can I do right now to get started? Keeping your questions small helps the resulting tasks remain manageable. The harder the task, the more effort it will require, and the more likely you'll be to put it off. make the tasks as effortless as possible. You can also apply this technique if you come to a standstill in your project. Even if you're held up by something or someone, chances are there's still an action you can take to keep the project moving forward. Ask yourself questions such as, what small step can I take now to move this forward? What could I improve now? It might be something as simple as researching relevant information on the internet, asking a few questions of a knowledgeable friend or colleague, recalibrating your sprints, or writing a long-form entry in your notebook about what you've learned so far. Challenging yourself to find opportunities for incremental improvement will often yield a way forward. It's a simple way of training yourself to become more proactive. The most powerful application of this technique is for problem solving. The bullet journal method did not appear fully formed. It was slowly assembled by solving one challenge at a time. Over the years, most of the solutions I tested didn't work. Yet I wouldn't describe those efforts as failures. Each attempt that missed the mark taught me something new, which ultimately led to a better solution. In the words of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, mistakes are a great educator when one is honest enough to admit them and willing to learn from them. When you run into issues, take a step back and start to tease them apart by asking small questions like, what exactly did not work? Why did it not work? What small thing can I improve next time? Whatever obstacles or challenges you may encounter along the way, meet them with curiosity, embrace them, and examine them by asking small questions. Don't let fear, pride, or impatience deprive you of the opportunity to ask. As Carl Sagan once said, there are naive questions, tedious questions, ill-phrased questions, questions put after inadequate self-criticism. But every question is a cry to understand the world. There is no such thing as a dumb question. Iteration. Once we have answers, we need to check them because they'll often be wrong. That's okay. It's simply part of the process of finding a solution. Thomas Edison supposedly once quipped, "I've not failed, I just found 10,000 ways that won't work." There's a benefit and utility in failure. When actively embraced as a learning mechanism, it can help us grow. Rather than perceiving failure as an end, it should be redefined as an essential part of the creative process, the unavoidable precursor to success. For example, Sir James Dyson, inventor of the Dyson vacuum cleaner, tested 5,126 prototypes to produce the results he wanted. Now he's valued at over $4 billion. Edison, Dyson, and many others like them honor their failures by actively reapplying the lessons they've learned. Failure allowed them to refine their ideas over and over again until they finally arrived at a solution that worked. This is known as the iterative cycle, which powers Kaizen. Iteration sounds more complicated than it is. Once you ask yourself a small question like, "What small thing can I change to make this better?" you've already started a process known as the Deming cycle, after W. Edwards Deming, the father of Kaizen. The Deming cycle provides us with a four-stage framework for continual improvement. Plan, do, check, act. Let's break that down. Number one, plan. Recognize an opportunity and plan a change. Two, do. Put the plan into play and test the change. Three, check. Analyze the results of your tests and identify what you learned. 4. Act. Act on what you've learned. If the change didn't work, go through the cycle again with a different plan. If you were successful, incorporate what you learned to plan new improvements. Rinse and repeat. Now let's see how you can implement this in your bullet journal. Every day can be viewed as an iterative cycle. The most straightforward way is to plan during your AM reflection, do during the day, and check and act during your PM reflection. As with all things bullet journal, this is not the only way it can be applied. You can run iterative cycles whenever you like, daily, weekly, or even during your monthly migration. What's important is that it becomes a regular part of your approach. Productivity is in large part a matter of consistency. Once you get it out of your head that you have to work at breakneck speed, you can focus on the process. Short of superhuman willpower, that's the only way you'll keep at it. better days. This may all seem like a lot of work, especially if you're feeling low, stuck, or overwhelmed. You tell yourself that you lack the money, energy, time, or will to tackle your professional goals, let alone your personal ones. Just because these thoughts are real does not make them true. Even at the very bottom, you have a choice. You can choose to focus on all the reasons why you can't, or you can look for some small way in which you can. If you're not happy with your life, then ask yourself, what tiny thing could I do tomorrow that would make my life a little bit better? Perhaps it's calling a friend, leaving a few minutes early to take the scenic route to work on a fine day, or tackling the chair that's drowning in your clothes. Again, we're looking for any win, no matter how small. Set the bar so low that you'll actually do it, and log it as a task in your bullet journal. Ask yourself the same question the next day. Find something, anything, that will make your life a little better. Perhaps catch up with another friend whose name came up during yesterday's call. Try getting coffee from that funky little place you discovered on the scenic route. Or sort one dresser drawer. Continue doing this every day for a month and keep track of it in your bullet journal. Before you know it, you'll have reconnected with people you care about, found fun new places, and enjoyed returning to a home that is less of a disaster. You've narrowed that gap between where you are and where you want to be. This is how small actions inspired by small questions can have an exponential positive impact on your life. Question by question, task by task, you're cultivating a sustainable path toward continual improvement and good change, one small step at a time. Time. In the end, it's not the years in your life that count. It's the life in your years. Abraham Lincoln. When asked to describe his theory of relativity, Einstein mercifully paraphrased it like this. When a man sits with a pretty girl for an hour, it seems like a minute. But let him sit on a hot stove for a minute, and it's longer than any hour. That's relativity. In other words, our perception of time changes relative to what we're doing. Just think about how different our perception of time is now compared to when we were kids. Back then, an hour-long car ride seemed to last forever. Are we there yet? The older we get, the less sensitive we become to the passage of time, and the less mindful we are about how we spend it. Deadline after deadline, goal after goal, time races by, especially when we're busy. Because our experience of time is so relative, it's easy to forget that it's a finite resource. Before we know it, we're out of time. The hard truth is, we can't make time. We can only take time. Though we can't make more, we can increase the quality of the time we take. Measuring the quality of time is not an exact science, but a key indicator is impact. How often have you sat at your desk all day, yet felt like you accomplished very little? Conversely, sometimes you sit down for a few hours and crank out a few days' worth of work. It has little to do with the amount of time you had. It's about how much attention you were able to bring into the present moment. Reining in your attention can prove difficult because our minds are incompetent time travelers. They have a tendency to get lost in both the past and the future. How often do we catch ourselves fixating on things we can't change or worrying about things we can't predict? That's a lot of time and energy siphoned away from the only place where we can actually make a difference, the here and now. The quality of our time is determined by our ability to be present. Our attention lives on a spectrum. On one side are things that repel our curiosity, like going to the DMV. On the opposite side of the spectrum is a state often referred to as flow, where we are most present and can have the most impact. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, PhD, the Hungarian psychologist who coined the term, spent his career studying what makes people happy. During his research, he interviewed creatives from all fields, from painters to poets to scientists. All described an ideal state in which their work seemed to take on a life of its own. Some described it as ecstatic. The root of the word ecstasy comes from the Greek ekstasis, which means standing outside oneself. Csikszentmihalyi posits that this feeling is the result of the mind being so consumed with the task that it cannot consciously process the experience of self. We enter flow when we're fully engaged. It's here, when we're totally present, that we unlock our full productive and creative potential. So is it possible to create flow? Flow, like happiness, is something that can't be forced. By being strategic with our use of time, however, we can create the conditions where flow is more likely to occur. In practice, time boxing. No matter how intentional your life may be, you probably have some responsibilities that are not necessarily enjoyable, but are unavoidable. We all do. Some may seem difficult, which scares us, having that heart-to-heart with our significant other, approaching our boss about a raise, giving a big presentation. Others may seem too easy, which bores us, cleaning the house, paying bills, routine stuff at work. We tend to put off both types of activities as long as we can. Of course, they don't just disappear. They tick away in our task list like time bombs. The longer we put them off, the more of a priority they become. That's how piddly stuff like paying bills becomes an energy-zapping, time-sucking, undeserving emergency of late charges, low balances, and financial angst that blows up in your face. We can diffuse these obligations through time boxing. As its name suggests, time boxing quarantines an activity to an allotted slot of time. It's designed to bring your full attention to something by only allowing you to focus on it for a predefined period of time. Time boxing adds two key motivational ingredients to a task you've been putting off: structure and urgency. If you only have 30 minutes a day to read something you'll be tested on, you'll make those 30 minutes count. You're making it painless enough to temper your impatience. This won't drag on, thank goodness. Simple enough that you won't get overwhelmed. This I can do. And challenging enough to engage your attention. Okay, 30 minutes to get my head into this. Brain, we got this. Go. Let's say you have to file your taxes in a month. Rather than waiting until the last minute and realizing that there's all sorts of stuff that you didn't take into account and then stressing out about it, break it down into time boxing sessions. For example, session 1 to 2, Sunday, 8:30 to 9 p.m., gather materials. Sessions 3 to 6, Monday, Wednesday, Sunday, 8:30 to 9 p.m., compile materials into spreadsheet. Session 7, Tuesday, 8:30 to 9 p.m., wrap up and submit files. Session 8, Thursday, last day, 8:30 to 9 p.m., provide any additional info. The key to creating flow is balancing the challenge of a task with your skill level. If you lack the skills for a given task, then that task can quickly cause anxiety and feel overwhelming. Time boxing allows you to whittle away at a task and incrementally improve your skill in the process. Over time, this can reduce how challenging something is. If, on the other hand, a task requires little to no effort, then our ability to engage is also very low. In this context, time boxing can be used to increase the challenge by creating a sense of urgency. Scheduling. Don't put it off, put it first. Our attention span drains throughout the day. When we do something has a large impact on how well we do it. If there's something that you find yourself putting off, then you've identified your chore. Procrastination indicates that it may be the most challenging task on your list because it worries you or doesn't interest you. Put it first. I fully appreciate not wanting to start the day with something that's not exciting or motivating. All the more reason to just get it out of the way. It's the pebble in your shoe. Take it out before it makes real trouble. Front-loading your day with the easy stuff is its own form of procrastination. Getting more onerous chores out of the way first makes the rest of your day feel easier. Like when running with weights on, you feel lighter and stronger as soon as they come off. Another benefit of this reverse hierarchy of tasks is that you're working your way towards things that interest you the most. It's much easier to maintain focus and motivation throughout the day when you have something to look forward to. That being said, we all have different biorhythms. Some people light up at night. The trick is to figure out when you're most focused and productive and plan accordingly. Memento Mori. It had been a year since I had last talked to my grandfather. I knew his health was failing, so I wrote "Call Grandy" in my bullet journal. But before I got around to it, he was gone. Most everyone I know has a similar story, a similar regret. Death provides the most salient reminder of the value of time. The Romans had a phrase, memento mori, which roughly translates to remember death. Legend has it that when the generals returned victorious from battle and paraded down the street, they had a servant whisper this phrase into their ear over and over to keep them humble and focused. That all living things must die is one of the few absolute truths we will ever know. Yet in the West, we all but demonize impermanence. Death is anthropomorphized as the Grim Reaper, a ghoulish enemy looming in the shadows, waiting to take everything from us. It's a terrifying notion that makes our relationship with the inevitable very one-sided. It doesn't need to be this way. Embracing the reality of impermanence can make the time we have significantly richer. Think of your favorite food. Let's say it's pizza. Suppose that one day you're told that you will get to enjoy pizza 87 more times in your life. Does this make you dislike, avoid, and dread eating pizza? Does pizza become depressing? No. It would likely be the opposite. Simply being aware that it's limited heightens your ability to experience it, to be more present, to savor each bite with an appreciation that had been unavailable to you before. Steadily reminding yourself that you, your insufferable colleague, your pet, your lover, your sibling, your parent will die, can fundamentally improve the nature of your interactions with all. It can make you more empathetic, forgiving, patient, kind, and grateful. Most of all, it can improve the quality of your time by helping you to become more present. Marcus Aurelius, Emperor of Rome and Stoic philosopher, once said, "You could leave life right now. Let that determine what you do, say, and think." How would your life change if you truly operated under those directives? Would everything stay the same? What would you do differently? What would you say differently? Did simply thinking this way pull things into greater clarity or offer a new perspective? The real question is, why don't we already operate this way? After all, this is the reality we inhabit. We can't always control what fate drops in our lap. In the moments where we do have a choice, we must be vigilant about what we let into our days because we don't have life to spare. During migration, we ask ourselves what is vital and what matters to help us filter out distractions from our lives. Sometimes they're hard questions to answer. Adding this lens of impermanence to your reflection can provide clarity by reminding you of what's at stake. We remember death, so we don't forget to make the most out of our time alive. Gratitude. Life is so subtle that sometimes you barely notice yourself walking through the doors you once prayed would open. Brianna Wiest. There's a scene in David Lynch's Twin Peaks where Special Agent Dale Cooper and Officer Harry S. Truman walk into the quaint Double R Diner. As they enter, Agent Cooper taps Officer Truman on the chest, smiling, and says, "I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Every day, once a day, give yourself a present." The present? An order of 2 cups of good, hot, black coffee. There's something deeply touching about this scene, in the weird, violent, and questionable sanity of the Lynchian world surrounding him. Cooper found a way to inject his life with some lightness. He's taking stock of the good. He loves this diner. He loves this coffee. And he's granting himself a moment to take it all in and appreciate it. Though he claims that this ritual is a secret, I would argue that it's an underrated skill available to us all. In the meditative tradition of mindfulness, we're taught to bring our attention into the moment. Be it doing the dishes, brushing our teeth, or standing in the checkout line, we're fully there, cultivating our ability to be present. A common misconception about meditation is that it's about getting rid of thoughts. Rather, mindfulness helps distance yourself from them. A helpful metaphor shared by one of my teachers was that if thoughts were cars, meditation helps us stand on the side of the road rather than getting stuck in traffic. It's easy to get so caught up in the traffic of our lives that we can easily pass right by even the most important of moments. A glowing example of this is how we fixate on achievement. If achievement is a defining measure of productivity, then what is the defining measure of achievement? In other words, why is achievement valuable? To prosper? To grow? It can be, but only if we take the time to examine the impact of our efforts. Just because you're driving at full speed does not mean you're going the right direction. The next time you cross off a task in your bujo, slow down. Take a moment to pause and reflect on the impact of your accomplishment. What do you feel? If by chance you feel nothing, or maybe nothing but relief, then chances are the thing you're working so diligently toward isn't adding much value to your life. That's a critical insight that needs to be recognized. If, on the other hand, you feel even a small sense of joy, pride, appreciation, or fulfillment, then you may be onto something. Gift yourself a moment to appreciate your accomplishment and acknowledge it because it's trying to reveal something to you. After all, if you can't appreciate your achievements, then what's the point? Your achievements have the power to nurture and guide you, but in order for that to happen, you need to take time to be grateful for them. In practice, celebration. Your bullet journal houses a running list of your tasks. Once complete, a task turns into an accomplishment. When crossing something off as complete, you're given an opportunity to acknowledge this accomplishment. If its impact is even remotely positive, celebrate it. If it's a big win, such as completing a milestone or a long-term goal, plan a proper celebration, ideally with those who are involved or are excited for your win. If it's a medium-sized achievement, maybe call a friend or call it a day a little earlier than usual. If it's a small achievement, smile, snap your fingers, do a fist pump, exclaim done. Enjoy the dopamine rush. Celebrating your victories isn't just about patting yourself on the back. It trains you to identify positive moments, which allows you to discover and enjoy more of them. Celebrating small wins can produce dramatic improvements in our self-perception and attitude. We tend to ruminate over all the things we got wrong, unaware of or ignoring all the things we got right. By celebrating our accomplishments, we're forcing ourselves to acknowledge our abilities and witness the proof that we can contribute. It shifts our attitude away from, how am I going to get all this done, to, look at all the things I've done, I've got this. Fear of failure will find less purchase in your mind. This is not a self-indulgence. It's an intentional means to build momentum, optimism, and resilience. A simple yet meaningful way to begin appreciating your achievements is to write them down. Committing them to paper makes you pause and honor a good moment with your attention. In the bullet journal, you can do this by logging events that you're grateful for in your daily log, in your monthly calendar, or in a gratitude log. Gratitude practice. Studies show that we need about 5 compliments to balance out every negative remark made toward us. That's because we remember negative events more intensely than positive ones. Introducing a gratitude practice, a simple process of regularly taking stock of what you're grateful for, is a good way to counteract your negativity bias by fostering an awareness of the positive things in your life. Having a gratitude practice has been shown to improve relationships, physical and mental health, empathy, self-esteem, lowering aggression, the list goes on. I like to think of it as helping our ongoing dialogue with life remain productive. With that in mind, let's take a look at 2 simple examples of how to incorporate a gratitude practice into your bullet journal. 1. In your daily log, during your PM reflection, write down more than one thing you're grateful for. Try to do this every day. 2. Create a gratitude collection. Again, write down more than one thing you're grateful for. Try to do this every day. If you're so inclined, you can even get creative with how you capture your favorite moments. I've included one such example in the bonus PDF. Chances are, you'll find yourself quickly running out of obvious things to be grateful for, such as health, home, family, friends, dogs, etc. The trick is to avoid repurposing the things you've listed before. That's when things get interesting. It's when we exhaust our stock answers that we begin to dig into our daily experience for material. It helps us become more present. As you actively examine your experience to find the good, you become better at locating it and appreciating it. You learn that, to paraphrase the Benedictine monk David Steindl Rast, you can't be grateful for everything, but you can be grateful in every moment. Even on the days when not much has moved forward, your gratitude practice will help you find things to appreciate, whether it's a coworker who helped you out, a stranger who opened a door, a meal you savored, or a parking space close to the entrance. It'll help you remain aware of the things that make life a little more enjoyable. Every day, once a day, give yourself the present of savoring the good in your life. Control. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Reinhold Niebuhr. The fact that all things must change is one of the few universal truths. On the one hand, it frightens us because things can change for the worse. We invest immense amounts of time and energy, not to mention money, trying to prevent or mitigate negative change, like losing our jobs, status, security, health, or relationships. The same is true for implementing positive change, be it our education, appearance, ability, or general personal growth. In both cases, a lot of that effort goes to waste because it's applied to things we simply have no power to change. Knowing what we can change begins with defining what's in our control. This endeavor is found at the heart of Stoicism, an ancient school of philosophy focused on cracking the age-old conundrum of how to live a good life. To Stoics, a critical part of the solution was to know the difference between the things we can and can't control. According to them, we can't control the world around us, nor the people in it. It's our futile resistance to this truth that can leave us frustrated, devastated, or at a total loss. For example, when we seek the approval or acknowledgement of others as a reward for our efforts, more often than not, we're left wanting or downright angry and confused when we don't get what we're looking for. Why are we feeling so bad? Because we set an expectation for something that isn't in our control. When you look at life through this lens, a lot of examples come to light. No matter how kind you are to someone, they just don't like you. You provide sound advice and your friend goes right out and does the opposite. You put in a ton of overtime only to get passed over for promotion. You open up your heart and it gets broken. The list, if we let it, can be endless. The more we try to control others, the more draining life becomes. If we can't control the world or people around us, all we're left with is the world within us, right? Well, we're complex, emotional creatures. We can't help but feel anger towards those who wrong us, or sadness at a loss. So no, we're not entirely in control of ourselves either. Bottom line, we can't control our feelings, people, or external events. But there is something we can control, and it's powerful. We can control how we respond to what happens to us. It's within our power to be intentional about how we respond to the wildly creative problems the world, people, and even our emotions subject us to. No matter what happens in your life, no matter how bad things get, you're never entirely at the mercy of your experience. There's always opportunity and freedom to be found in how we choose to act. It's our obligation, then, to make the most of this freedom. As bullet journalist Trey Kaufman writes, "If my computer so much as hiccuped, I'd take it out on my mouse and keyboard in awful ways, which is like punching a puddle to lash out at the rain." When I started bullet journaling, I began asking why before getting upset about every little thing. If someone cut me off on the freeway, I'd ask myself why I'd get upset about something I can't control. Now I just allow more space between my car and the one in front of me. In practice, responding versus reacting. Our reactions are often more instinctual than intentional, especially when a situation or a person is doing their best to bring out our worst. Say your colleague Chad offends you and you puff up like a blowfish trying to protect yourself. You could waste so much time contemplating the many ways in which Chad is wrong about you, about the situation, about his choice in shoes, and about life in general. Or worse, you lash out at him, he lashes back, and it spirals down from there until you're both on the same low rung of the evolutionary ladder. We waste our energy trying to protect ourselves because deep inside we're animals. When our ancestors were triggered, they survived by either running or biting, fight or flight. Some time has passed since we swung from trees, and we now have other options available to us. We can do better. Rather than gently ushering Chad out the window, take a deep breath, and don't take the bait. Let the heat of the moment pass. During your daily reflection, you can start to examine the experience from a better place. Why did he say or do what he did? Why would he volunteer this questionable opinion? Why did it upset you exactly? What are your options here? Use these thoughts to formulate a measured response in the form of a letter written in your bullet journal. Now, to be clear, this letter isn't necessarily for Chad. It's for you to get your thoughts straight. It's to reveal opportunities and insights that may have been obscured in the heat of the moment. This trick has helped me deal with very challenging people and situations. First of all, it allows you to safely vent. Getting it all out of your head offers some much-needed relief. Seeing your thoughts on paper can also highlight where you're being petty, unreasonable, or even irrational. With that out of the way, you can begin to dial it back, restating your case in a calm and considered way, and to figure out productive next steps. For example, it might hit you that a main source of contention is that you don't understand where the other person is coming from. You can probably get clarity on that. If you're able to have a conversation with the other person, try to actually hear what they're saying. You may realize that they have a point. Perhaps they misperceived something, and if you were in their place, you'd be angry also. The fact that they acted like a ding-dong doesn't make them wrong, and just because you were offended does not make you right. In the process of writing this letter, perhaps you realize what they said or did has nothing to do with you. In the heat of a challenging moment, it's easy to forget that our assailant may be struggling with their own measure of pain. By reacting with fear or anger, we only deepen their wounds and ours, severing opportunities for understanding, progress, or resolution. We also prolong wasting time and energy worrying about something that we can't control. Process versus outcome. Mark Twain once wrote, "I've had a lot of worries in my life, most of which never happened." Worry has a way of holding our attention hostage. This is especially true for things we can't control due to the elevated level of uncertainty. We burn through a lot of resources obsessing over possible outcomes and forming contingency plans. But in reality, we're just fueling our anxiety. Trying to think our way out of a situation beyond our control may feel productive, but it's nothing more than a powerful distraction. Worry baits us with the promise of a solution, but usually offers none. As the Dalai Lama once said, "If a problem can be solved, there is no use worrying about it. If it can't be solved, worrying will do no good." During your daily reflection or monthly migration, scan your tasks and try to identify what is and what is not in your control. An easy tell is if your tasks are focused on outcome rather than process. Give awesome presentation, lose 10 pounds, read 5 books, or get Chad to see reason are goals. Though goals provide direction, they focus on outcomes that are ultimately out of our control. This is why we break our goals down into small actionable steps. Memorize presentation, no soda on Sunday, set aside reading time, and address Chad's concerns. These are things you can control. By identifying what is out of our control and letting go, we can reclaim our attention and reinvest it into the things that are. Focus on doing everything within your control to help something succeed. There is nothing more that can be asked of us. More importantly, there is nothing more that we can ask of ourselves. Radiance. As a man changes his own nature, so does the attitude of the world change towards him. Mahatma Gandhi. Think about a toxic colleague you've worked with. Though you may be pretty content with your job, what does it feel like when they badmouth the company, complain about their work, or manipulate people to get what they want? It leaves a bad taste in your mouth. It stays with you. Without even realizing it, you can spread that negativity to your partner over dinner, or even to your partner's colleagues the next day, one study found. Like a pebble dropped into a lake, our actions ripple out into the world around us. Each ripple influences what it encounters, which in turn ripples out even farther. When you hold the door open for someone, for example, they may inspire a willingness for them to do so for the next person or to extend a different kindness that would not have existed without your influence. Similarly, when you snap at someone, chances are their spouse, friend, or child will be subject to the ripple effects of your action. I like to refer to this ability of ours to influence the world around us as our radiance, literally, what we radiate. The nature of our radiance is often a reflection of what's going on inside. It's why cultivating self-awareness, far from being selfish, is vitally important. If we remain unaware of, or unwilling to, take responsibility for our lesser qualities, such as negativity or anger, we will inevitably pass them on to those in our proximity. The charge of your words or actions begins to shape the world around you to parallel the one within. Your lack of enthusiasm for a project drains the team of theirs. Watch your bad mood be served back to you in the silence of your partner over dinner. I'm not suggesting that you force yourself to become a chirpy Disney character with rainbows of perpetual optimism blasting out your nose. Rather, we have an obligation to address our weaknesses and to build on our strengths because we're not alone. Cultivating our potential makes us more valuable to ourselves and to others, especially those closest to us. Though you can't control people, you will in some way influence those that you come in contact with, and they, in turn, may carry forward that influence. Your knowledge can teach others. Your hard work can inspire others. Your positive mood can uplift others. Seth Godin once wrote, "You're either the person who creates energy or you're the one who destroys it." Bettering yourself leads to bettering others, and if we play that ripple effect all the way out to its infinite potential and multiply it by every willing soul, to bettering the world. If you don't want to become better for yourself, do it for them. If your goal in life is to be useful to others, you can start by figuring out how to be useful to yourself. In practice, self-compassion. Take a moment to think of a friend who's going through a rough patch. Maybe they messed up at work, or were cruel to someone, or just got dumped. Whatever it is, they're feeling pretty lousy about themselves. You probably patiently sat there and listened to them, fixate on all the ways in which they are a terrible or useless person. Maybe you tried to correct their distorted self-perception. You pointed out the things they do well and the things they do right. You reminded them how much you care about them and that everyone makes mistakes. Perhaps you tried suggesting a way forward, because you know that dwelling on perceived failures or shortcomings is entirely unhelpful. At the very least, you listened. We're happy to offer support and solace to those we care for. What if we extended the same kindness to ourselves? Easier said than done, right? We can find countless reasons to be hard on ourselves, especially if we're insecure, are sensitive, or breathe. We need to start trading in browbeating for some clear-eyed, compassionate counsel that we'd offer to others. Self-compassion can start by asking yourself a simple question. What would I tell a friend in this situation? Asking this question interrupts our inner critic and makes us switch gears into problem-solving mode. Can you imagine if a tormented friend came to you for help and all you did was exacerbate their suffering? Of course you can't, because you're a good friend and you care. Yet that's exactly what many of us do to ourselves all the time. The next time you find yourself beating up the person who blows out your birthday candles, pretend that you're taking care of a friend in need. What patient and compassionate advice would you offer to help them overcome or recontextualize their situation? If they messed up at work, for example, it could tip off a downward spiral where they start questioning their ability, their worth, and so on. They quickly lose perspective. One simple way to make them feel better is to present evidence that would force them to question their inner critic. We can use the same tactic when we face our own. When we've erred, the voice of our inner critic grows loud and it can be most convincing. Luckily, we have some pretty compelling evidence to prove them wrong, and it's penned in our own hand. If you've been using your daily log, you've recorded clear examples of your success, ability, kindness, caring, etc. This is especially true if you're keeping a gratitude log. Whatever it is that you may be faulting yourself for, it's likely that you'll find inarguable proof to the contrary within the pages of your bullet journal. When you're down, look at these examples during your reflections. Show yourself the evidence and allow yourself to accept it. It may be hard, and you may remain skeptical at first, but try to make room in the dark inner choir for a benevolent voice. The longer that voice remains, the more opportunities it has to be heard. Over time, you may just be willing to trust it. Mutual improvement. Radiance is a two-way street, so be mindful about the people you surround yourself with, because they will shape you. Their strengths and weaknesses can have tremendous influence on your own trajectory. It's critical, therefore, to be deliberate about who you cultivate relationships with, both professionally and personally. Look through your bullet journal to see who you're spending time with. You may know how you feel about them, but have you ever considered their impact on you? Start to take notes on some of these interactions. Don't worry, you're not keeping creepy records on your friends. You're simply becoming mindful of how their radiance affects you. Add some notes about the dinner, date, or meeting when you get home. Did you have fun? What did you learn? Was most of your time spent just sitting there listening to their problems again? How do you feel when you're with them? You can quickly capture it like this. Event: dinner with Becca at Evelina's. Note: talked about aspirations. Note: want to travel to Portugal together. Note: want to co-host the next party. Note: always leave feeling motivated after we hang out. It may seem awkward at first, but recording your interactions grants you the opportunity to articulate something you may not have otherwise. You never know what it could reveal. Maybe you realize that the relationship is vampiric. It often leaves you feeling drained. Or that it's one-sided. You always call and put in all the work. In contrast, you may realize that some people leave you feeling inspired, lighter, energized, contemplative, or calmer. Whatever the case may be, you're becoming more aware so you can be intentional about managing your relationships, including which relationships are worth managing at all. Negative or unmotivated people in your life may sabotage your efforts to live with intention. Try to keep company with those you find inspiring, motivating, and constructively challenging. Ask yourself, what can I learn from them? Is the world a bit of a better place because they're in my life? Do they make me want to be a better person? As Joshua Fields Milburn of The Minimalists once quipped, you can't change the people around you, but you can change the people around you. You get to choose who you spend your precious time with. Surround yourself with people who want the best for you. That doesn't mean they'll always agree with you or be indiscriminately supportive, No. Find people who want you to succeed, even if that means having hard conversations, disagreeing with you, and telling you when you're wrong or being unreasonable. We all need to be checked from time to time.